the Berean class, alias the connecting class, and we're studying the book of Daniel, Christian living in a post-Christian culture. And one of the things that we hope to have happen whenever we open the Word of God is to learn wisdom, that is to go away wiser in a spiritual sense than when we came. And that's my prayer always in teaching and in listening. When the Word of God is open, I want to leave wiser. That doesn't mean I necessarily learn something new, but I see something different in such a way that it affects the way I believe and the way I behave. That's my objective. And I want to begin by asking or raising a question that is as old as the hills, but still never goes away. How does God work His will in the world? If we believe that God is alive, He's there, and He cares, and all-powerful, how do we make sense of a world that He's supposed to be involved in, have His hand involved in? Everything seems to be so confusing to us, at least to me. Is everything that happens really directed by God? That's one of the implications. If He's in control, then basically He's directing the things that take place. Christians claim that God is caring, involved, and in control of history. And we keep preaching that. But we've got to have a lot of faith to buy that lie. If we're going to be objective in terms of observing our own lives and the lives of people around us. R.C. Sproul puts it this way. If there is one single molecule in the universe running around loose, totally free of God's sovereignty, then we have no guarantee that a single promise of God will ever be fulfilled. Wow. R.C. Sproul is a big audience. And he would draw our attention to passages like Romans chapter 9 and verse 21. Or does not the potter, that is God, have the right over the clay, that's us, to make from the same lump one vessel for honorable use and another for common use? He makes the vessels honorable or common. That's what Paul seems to be saying here. Now, I don't think that's what he's really saying, but that's the way it's read often. And then we go to Daniel chapter 4. That's the passage we're going to be looking at today, the chapter we're going to be looking at this week. At the end of the chapter, we read Nebuchadnezzar's faith confession. But he does, that is he, being God, Nebuchadnezzar saying this, but he does according to his will in the hosts of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and no one can ward off his hand or say to him, what have you done? Now, one of the great themes in the book of Daniel, if you've read the book of Daniel, which I hope you have, you can't hardly escape this. It's the sovereignty of God. If there's one theme that comes up over and over again throughout almost every chapter, is that God is sovereign. God is in control. The things that happen are orchestrated by God. And this chapter, I think, is the crown jewel of that particular doctrine. And we can look at chapter 4 and divide it basically into to these sections. It starts with the king making a confession about his convictions. God is sovereign. That's what he's saying. Then he gives a testimony as to how he came to believe that and see that. He tells a story about having a dream, having that dream interpreted by someone, and him being, or not a dream, he built we'll get to it. He has a story as to how he came to that conviction. Then at the end of the chapter, he basically says the same thing again. God is sovereign. Now, a lot of commentators think that this is a flowing narrative. I don't think it is. I think it's basically his testimony. He's saying, what I believe, this is how I came to that belief, and again, this is what I believe. For example, in the first section, verse 3, we read this: how great are his signs and how mighty are his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion is from generation to generation. Now we go to the end of the chapter. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. And he goes on. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, but he does according to his will in the host of heavens and among the inhabitants of the earth. And no one can ward off his hand and say to him, what have you done? And here basically is what happened that brought him to that conviction. He has a dream of impending doom that troubles him. He doesn't know the meaning of the dream, but he knows that it's threatening. He asks Daniel to interpret the dream. And the dream is of a great tree that covers the entire earth. And it's cut down by an angelic watcher, with only a stump being left. And its owner goes insane. And this is for the purpose that the world might know that God is sovereign over all the earth. Verse 16 of Daniel 4. This is part of what would be happening in this vision. And his mind be let his mind be changed from that of a man, that's the owner of the tree. Let the beast's mind be given to him. And let 7 periods of time, presumably 7 years, pass over him. This sentence is by the decree of the angelic watchers, and the decision is a command of the holy ones, in order that the living may know that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind, and bestows it, that is, power in the kingdom, on whom he wishes, and sets over it the lowliest of men. And then it goes on. The dream comes true. The king is made like a wild beast. He's taken away from his power, and he wanders in the wilderness like an animal for 7 years. But then in the end, he's restored, and he basically gets everything back. His kingdom comes back. That's his testimony. That's how he learned that God is sovereign. Now, when we talk about divine providence, I think a good place to start is with a definition. What do we mean by divine providence or God's sovereignty in the things of the world? Divine providence is, I believe, the active implementation of God's plan for his creation so that his strategic purposes are realized and his Son is ultimately glorified. Now, the question is, okay, but does that mean that God really controls every detail of life? Does he control the fact that, for example, on the banner outside when you came in with the map and all these little pointers going someplace, the heading was left out. Someone forgot to put the heading, local ministries. Now, if you look at it, you can figure it out, but somebody neglected to put the sign out. Is that decreed by God? Then God, in his sovereign decree, decided that will not happen for some reason. Well, some people would say every molecule is dictated by God. Divine providence generally is understood in terms of three spheres. First of all, there are the laws of nature. That's the normal way in which God works. Now, sometimes you think of nature as being contrary to God. That is not the way the Bible describes it. The laws of nature are simply a description of a common way in which God orchestrates or governs and providentially cares for his creation. It's not God's normal way of operating. And this is almost universally recognized. There's no question about the laws of nature, by and large. And then we have miracles. That's the exceptions where God orchestrates events sometimes to interrupt the normal way of operating in nature. This is contested. Some people would say there are no real miracles. They are just laws of nature we have not yet discovered or understood. But one day we will. Still others would suggest there are degrees of miracles. A class A miracle is the resurrection of the dead. There's no way in which that can be explained hypothetically. There are other miracles that basically are class B and class C miracles. A class C miracle would be the fact that basically my child was born normal. Praise God. We were praying that he'd have a normal delivery and a healthy child. He was healthy. Praise God, it's a miracle. Well, most people would say that's not a miracle. That's basically a part of nature. But there are degrees in which we can see God's hand personally involved in our lives. God delivered us from a circumstance. God found me a job. I didn't have a job, and I got a job. And that's not on the order of a resurrection from the dead. That's more like a law of nature. And we can link it to our prayers and to our hard work in some way. But there are degrees in which God's hand is involved. But when it comes to the decrees of God, these are God's preordained agendas that are in the dark. We don't see them. They simply are told to us that God is sovereign, and we have to accept that. It's a mystery to us. How can human choice and God's design plan work together? That's the big question. If God really is in control of everything that takes place, all the details, every molecule, as R.C. Sproul suggests, then how can you judge anyone for their decisions if they're preordained? And what is the meaning of love if love is preordained? If I'm simply robotically loving or hating people, I mean, where does love have any meaning for? What about worship? If I'm just a robot on the end of a puppeteer's strings, how is worship and love and judgment, how ethics at all? It all loses meaning if God is sovereign in that sense. So we have questions. Why is this question important? Well, some people are going to say, probably you're thinking this right now, Jim, we've been here. We've talked about this subject. I've read about it. We know what the bottom line is. It's a mystery. Just go on with something else. It's relevant. Well, I had a vision this week. It's no longer a mystery. There are three reasons why this is important. One, coherence builds a strong faith, and incoherence, that is, commitment to a mystery, does not. I'm not suggesting we understand everything. We don't. But we all need to and do seek for coherence. The more I understand about how my faith works together with reality, the stronger my faith is. This is why Paul argues the way he does in Romans. He wants us to commit our lives to Christ knowing this about what Christ has done, and the connection between what he's done and who we are and how we should behave. He wants us to connect those dots, understand that. When we understand it, we say, aha, now I understand why it's in my best interest as a worshiper of Jesus Christ who has died to himself to basically bless those who persecute me. Now I understand why that makes sense. That's a way in which I identify with Christ and display to the world the hope that the world doesn't know anything about, and basically gets their attention, shocks them into the reality of maybe there's something more than just the stuff that I've tried to gather for myself. Secondly, pride. It's a temptation when we are aware of God's sovereign power, but of nothing else. Someone has said that heresies are an attempt, usually, to solve an insolvable problem by taking one side and ignoring the other. And when we take the side of the fact that God is sovereign over everything and everything that happens is God's will, it's decreed, so forth and so on, the temptation is to go in one direction or the other. Either be prideful or passive. If I feel responsible for everything, then basically I take the credit. If I'm responsible for nothing, it's very easy to be passive and just basically say, well, what will be, will be. You know, I'm going to do what I want to do. In 1 Corinthians chapter 13 and verse 12, we're reminded that we can't know everything. That's I don't have to tell you let's just be reminded of it. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Someday we will. Now I know in part, but then I will know fully, just as I also have been fully known. And by knowing, I don't think we're going to have all our questions answered. I think we're going to know something that will bring us to a place where we're not asking any more questions. We won't have to have answers to all our questions. I have some pastor friends who are making a list of the questions they want to ask God when they go to heaven. I hope they take the list with them, because it's the only way they're going to remember what those questions are. When we see Christ, my sense is, we're not going to have any questions anymore. We're going to be thinking about different things. The petty things of life are going to pass away. We're going to see a light that's going to be so bright that it's going to take away all of those petty things. A full explanation of God's sovereignty lies above our human purview. Job makes this very clear. Speaking of God, who does great and unsearchable things, wonders without number? Can you discover the depths of God? Can you discover the limits of the Almighty? Do you hear the secret counsel of God and limit wisdom to yourself? These are the challenges given to Job. And the obvious answer is, God is God. We have a very limited perspective. Now, one of the ways of illustrating this in a different sphere is to look at the ability of the human senses in terms of their limitations, in terms of just sight and hearing. For example, we can take the entire spectrum of light waves, and when we look at the part of light rays that we have access to through our senses, it's very small. The color spectrum of human vision is very small compared to the whole gamut of rays that are available out there. The same is true with hearing. The part of the spectrum of human hearing is very small compared to the entire spectrum of sounds that are available to us. Now, most of us only know the world here and the world here. The world that elephants live in is here, and mice live in is here. But that's something that's a world we don't know anything about. If you have a dog whistle, your dog whistle speaks out here someplace, but not here. You can't hear it, but the dog can. The point is, there's a lot out there going on that's real in terms of physics, in terms of chemistry. It's real. We just don't have access to it. Now, if that's true in the physical realm, how much more in the spiritual realm is possible? We know that God's creation extends beyond the physical cosmos to include the ages. That's the word for worlds here. Or history. That's the idea. When in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 3, we read these words, "By faith we understand that the worlds were prepared by the word of God, so that what is seen was not made out of things which are visible." This is the biblical account of creation. What we have in Genesis chapter 1 and 2 is basically the formation of the earth as we know it after this. It starts, Genesis 1 starts with the world without form and void, chaos, and God makes cosmos from chaos. But it starts with something in Genesis 1. This is the scripture that talks about where it all started, from nothing. God spoke not only matter into existence, he spoke history into existence. He spoke and orchestrated the things that would be seen, not just physically, but the things that we would experience in terms of the ages. The real question is not, how can human free choice and God's design plan work together? But rather, how big is our God? That's the real question. Let me illustrate this. And this basically are the things that have enabled me to have peace with this issue without saying it's just a big mystery. Illustration number one. God's sovereignty, or his power to control, is a function of his creative wisdom. How many of you have seen the television program Whose Line Is It Anyway? Anyone? Some of you have. More than I expected. It's a British show. I don't particularly like it, but it is humorous and it's novel. And here's how it goes. Jim Carrey, who's the commentator of the Master of Ceremonies, goes to the audience and he says, "Give me a topic." Someone will say, "Horseback riding." Okay. Then he turns to the four comedians on the stage who are professional comedians. It's all ad lib. And they are creative, they're smart, and he says, "You are a TV evangelist, you are a weatherman, you are a sports announcer, and you are an infomercial salesperson. Now, tell me your story in three or four sentences with the subject." And it's hilarious. They will make up a song, or a poem, or tell a story involving the subject, whatever it might be, from their perspective. The creative part comes from their ability to think on their feet instantly and make it humorous. Make it work. Now, if they can take a subject at random and a role at random and instantly make it work so it makes sense humorously, how much more can God, who has infinite creativity and knowledge, take whatever happens and make it work for his purposes? And you say, "Well, hold it. You know, that's a story. That's hypothetical. We're dealing with real life." They can create humor out of anything. So what about real life? Okay, illustration number two. Who is this? No, you don't know who this is? Oh. This is perhaps the greatest college football player ever. Johnny Football Manziel. He won the Heisman Trophy this year. The most prized trophy or award in all of college athletics, any sport. He's a freshman. He's 6'1", 190 pounds. He doesn't look like a football player. That's a high school picture, I think. No, it's not. Texas A&M. He single-handedly beat Alabama, went on to win the national championship this year, for those of you who aren't football fans. He's a quarterback. He's a wonder. Even his opponents say, "We don't know no way to stop him." Now, what makes him so good? He makes plays in any circumstance. He's not the strongest guy, not the fastest guy, but whatever defense was thrown against him, whatever his linemen did or didn't do, he'd find some way to make the play work. Now, if Johnny Football Manziel, and by the way, when you get the tag football that is recognized nationally behind your name as a college athlete, you're unique. And most people know him as Johnny Football, not Johnny Manziel. If he can make things work no matter what the circumstances are, how much more can an infinite God with infinite power, infinite knowledge, infinite wisdom and creativity take the circumstances of life, no matter what they are, and make them work for his purposes? Illustration number two. Again, God's sovereignty, power, function, his is a function of his creative power and wisdom, or creativity and wisdom, is seen in Genesis 1, where God changes chaos to cosmos. The very first thing we learn about God is that he has the ability to take things that are random and meaningless and going in every direction and no direction and bring order into them in such a way that the environment is one that sustains the most complex element we know in nature, and that is human life. God's sovereign power also is a function of his knowledge. I'll illustrate it this way. I can give my grandson, Alex, free choices. Because I know him, I know what he will choose. Now, when he brings out his toy truck, and I have a Hello Kitty sticker or a Batman sticker, which one do you think he's going to want? ask him if he likes tofu or not, what is he going to say? Upper, it's not or up. That shows you don't know Alex. He's half Japanese. He loves tofu. I know that. Now, if God, who knows me and you infinitely, he knows us better than we know ourselves, if he has that kind of knowledge of us, why is it so difficult for him to get his way with us? He doesn't have to tweak much. He knows about my background. He knows about my temperament. He knows about my preferences. He knows about my choices. I can have a free choice. God knows what it's going to be. I think it's free. I'm deciding this morning, do I have basically eggs or cereal? I'm wrestling with that. God knows that ultimately the forces that are determining the decision are all calculated in his mind and clear to him. They're not clear to me. No matter how it comes out, he knows. And he doesn't have to control me to do that. Illustration number three. God's sovereign power to control is not threatened by my choices. If I were to go one-on-one with LeBron James playing basketball, what do you think would be the outcome? I've got a pretty good shot and got some good moves. And LeBron James could say, I know, Jim, but it makes no difference. You're free to do anything you want. You can take any shot you want, any move you want, but the question I have is, do you want the game to be long or short? Again, his power makes my choices virtually subservient. The same is true if I were to play chess with Carlsen Magnus. He's the age of what could be my grandchild. But if I were playing chess with him, he could say, you're free to move any way you want. How many moves do you want before the game's over? He's that good. He's the best in the world. He's just a boy. This gives new meaning to the passage that's well worn in Romans 8, 28. And we know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God and to those who are called according to his purpose. We might say, and to God's purposes. God causes all things to work together. He has the creativity, the wisdom, and the knowledge, and if needed, the power to make whatever we throw at him work together for his good. Now, we can't do that. We can't understand, basically, how anyone could be that powerful, that wise, that creative. But we can imagine it. And it goes back to, again, how can human free choice and God's design plan work together? Is our God too small? And for many of us, we are afraid that he is. My sense of R.C. Sproul's quote, his God is too small. Because his God has to control everything in order to be in control. My God is big enough that he doesn't have to control anything that we do in order to get his way. I may not understand that power, but I can recognize and see how it's possible. It can be it can't be that difficult for a God who is infinitely wise, powerful, and creative. And what that means for us is this. When we contemplate the glory and the power and the wonder of and the expanse of wisdom in our God, we've got to let God be God and focus on our role. As opposed to trying to make sure God didn't miss something. Or to try to tell him that it's got to work this way. Or to assume that our way must be God's way. That's usually what happens. God basically is there to make our plans work. To help our ship come in. He's the pilot of our ship coming in. He's the one that lays out the red carpet for us. And our plans, and ultimately us, become the real issue. The end of Daniel 4 has these words. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise, exalt, and honor the King of Heaven, for all his works are true and his ways just, and he is able to humble those who walk in pride. And when we basically find ourselves having to take control, we invite also with that pride and a sense of guilt because we can't do it. When we try to take God's role, most of us just aren't up to it, even though some of us convinced we are. We just don't do that very well. Two concerns. One is pride. We're responsible for too much. The other is passivity. We're responsible for too little. When we think we are in control, it goes through our head. When we think that we do doesn't matter, we go to sleep. And two concerns, two virtues, trust and obey. We have a part, but it's not the writing, the directing, or the producing. We must know our role and play it well. And with that, limit our involvement. Now, that is hard for many of us, because we'd like a different role. We tend to whine and worry about God's providence, that the writer didn't get it right, the producer's not doing his job, that the director, you know, he can't be trusted. We tend to miss our cue, forget our lines, and win another role. Isn't that where most of us struggle? This is where I struggle. I mean, when things don't go the way I expect them to go, basically I feel responsible. And in some respects, I've got good reason to feel responsible. I know that I did this to cause this and so forth and so on. I live in a contingent world where things that happen are linked to things that happened before. And I'm linked somewhere to the responsibility of that. And there's a certain truth in there. There's a lot of truth in that. But ultimately, I've got to recognize that in a world of chaos, I serve a God who produces cosmos. In a world where bad things happen to good and bad people, where I make big mistakes, and where people make big mistakes that affect me. In that world, somehow God has the creativity, the wisdom, and the knowledge to bring that together for good. And to, at the end of the day, have his purposes accomplished. Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God, Paul says. How unsearchable are his judgments, unfathomable his ways. I mean, this is the way Paul concludes this whole matter. We have a very, very big God who's infinitely creative and wise and knowledgeable. Now, that still leaves us with lots of questions. But we've got to move on to Daniel chapter 5. And he's getting, yes, Dorothy.
Why are you so confused about such things as fascism and the destruction of 6 million Jews? And,
right.
You know, things of that.
And know. The crucifixion of Christ. And
yeah.
You know.
Well, not so much the crucifixion of Christ, because I think that's far more individualistic. And what you said can be read into all of that, but once you find the destruction of civilizations, I have trouble with that. Because it does bring yeah. so much pain and agony
right.
to so many good people.
Right. Well, and again, it's whether it's individual or corporate, that the injustice from our perspective really seems to be there. Why would God choose the Jews? I mean, he could have made much better choices than the Jews. And the Old Testament says that. I mean, these are stiff-necked people. They were when he chose them. He knew that. And you look at their history. They were fighting God all the way. We think of the Jewish people as the chosen race and then basically say, these are a sacred, anointed race of people who have godliness in their veins. Oh, come on. Read the Old Testament. It's just the opposite. Why would God do that? Well, Paul says he chose them as a part of his plan to bring redemptive grace to the whole planet. I said, boy, I wouldn't have had a plan like that, but God did. And this is why, you know, ultimately, after a while, I have to recognize, you know, I really don't have quite enough creativity, knowledge, and wisdom to be concocting plans. So, as a bit player in this play, I look at what the director and the writer and the producer passed down as my script. It doesn't seem like much to me. And furthermore, I don't know where this is all going. But in the end, it's like putting together a movie. I don't put together movies, but I understand the way movies are put together. They aren't put together in sequence. The director, the writer, the producer sees the big picture, but oftentimes the last scene is filmed first in France, in the someplace. And the actors in that part, all they know is a bit part they're in. They don't know anything about what happened in the whole movie. They just play their part. And the director, producer, and the writer bring it all together and tell the story at the end. When I was in high school, I played football. I started out as a freshman playing in the line because I was big and strong. And when I was a senior, I was a running back, believe it or not. I played for 4 years. I remember what it was like playing as a freshman in the line on defense. Now, if you haven't played football in the line, you don't know what this is like, but you can imagine it. When you watch a football game, as you will, some of you this afternoon, this evening on television, you'll see the whole play, what's going on. When you're a lineman, you don't see anything. Mm-hmm. You just see the ground and the guy in front of you. And you have an assignment. You block him right or left, or push him back, or basically something else. But that's all you see. And after every play, you're picking yourself off of the ground. The play's over. You never saw it. Unless you watch it on television later. Or someone describes it to you. Every play, that's what you do. You block the guy in front of you. Now, when you're the coach, or when you're a spectator, you see the whole play. That's very different. But if you don't do your part, the play doesn't work the way it should. Or you need a Johnny Manziel, you know, to pull it out in some way. Yes. But the point I'm making is this. We are in the place where we don't see how this could possibly work. But we can imagine how it might work. Yes?
And I think that ties directly to her confusion about, you know, why certain devastating things happen in history. And from our vantage point, we have a whole lot of history that we can look back on and study and learn a lesson from for our own individual participation in history that's being made right now.
Right.
And you mentioned a while ago about one of the extreme reactions is passivity. And I think if we look at what's happening either currently or in recent history and question why God allowed that, and we don't learn a lesson for ourselves about how we can make a difference right now in the role that we have to play, then I think that we're being passive in that regard.
If my focus has got to be on my role and doing it well, not on saying, I won't do this until I see how it fits into the big picture and makes sense. I mean, that's the problem. Maybe with God's role. But I think if we block and tackle, you know, the guy in front of us, or the guy that's running the ball toward us, that's our role. And if we do that part well, we leave the directing and the producing and the writing to God.
And I think in some ways we pass too much judgment on other people's roles in life. You know, we tend to elevate certain types of jobs and skills and talents and downplay somebody else's role that God wants them to play.
Right.
And so we do all of the community a disservice.
I noticed when I was a lineman, I didn't score any touchdowns. I just happened to notice that. Very strange how that happens. But when I was running back, it was very different. Still didn't score very many touchdowns, but it was good. describing it. Yes.
So, Jim, so bring me back to R.C. Sproul.
Okay.
And what intellectual advance have you made over him? let me piece this up.
Okay.
Advance in human understanding that God is big.
Yeah.
All right. So, and then you've got God ways are a mystery to me. Use the word mystery.
Right.
People
right.
who just put him in the mystery box, we're going to make an advance. We're going to say God is big.
Right.
Well, but you're still, I guess you're giving some allowance for free will there. I'm trying to see what is the advance.
Yeah.
Moving from Sproul's.
Right. Well, what I'm suggesting is that we do have real freedom in the sense that we make real choices. God doesn't dictate our choices. We can make choices in any direction, but He has a way of taking our choices along with other things, working all things together. He can work them together for good. In the same way that Johnny Manziel does not have to dictate what his linemen do or what the defense does in order for him to be successful. He takes whatever is thrown at him and he responds to it in such a way that he is able to make things happen.
But you still end up with mystery from our point of view.
So, yes, there's a certain sense in which I can't understand what infinite creativity looks like. Now, I know what creativity looks like. I know what wisdom looks like. But I, like a spectrum of light or of sound, I just see a very small part of that. And there, yes, there's a lot I don't understand about that. But I think that the part that is troubling to my faith, that makes my faith intellectually difficult, is when someone says, just believe that God orchestrates every detail. That makes no sense to me. That's something that basically I find requires more faith than I've got. Knowing other things that Scripture tells me about my responsibilities, and about the way the world is, and my observation about the way the world works. There is a real measure in which I have volition that makes a difference. There is cause and effect that I can trace and measure. That's something that I can't deny. When someone asks you to deny that, and yet becoming a Christian or being a Christian means you deny that you really have free will. It's just an illusion. God controls everything. That's something that I find challenging to my faith. Yes. Well, some more yours first. Yes?
Something that sort of helps me think of this, although it's not an excellent analogy, is the parent-child relationship. As a parent, I have to let my children, if they're going to grow up, make decisions. I may know they're bad decisions, I may know they're wrong, but they
right.
make them. That doesn't mean that child is in control. And I think what helps me is to remember that I am always the child in the relationship with God.
Right.
And so He is free. He lets me make decisions, whether they are good or bad decisions. He lets me make them because He knows He's growing me up into the person He needs me to be or He's
yes.
letting me become. So that kind of helps. It's not an excellent analogy, but it helps
yes.
me remember. Yep. How it all works.
Right, right. And I guess that's a good illustration of a parent and child. The child has to be given freedom. There's no freedom, there's no real growth in that context. But when I look at the children of Israel, Daniel and his friends in Babylon's Nebuchadnezzar's court, one of the fears that they had to be wrestling with, and we'll look at this next week, was the temptation to do whatever they had to survive because they were the remnant. The 10 tribes were lost to the Assyrians. They are the only tribe that's left, and now they're swept off into Babylon. Without them, Israel does not exist. As we're going to see next week, the temptations that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego faced in the fiery furnace were tremendous. Because the fate of Israel, in some sense, was in the balance. And we're going to see in that chapter, things that really are displays of character and trust that challenge us, because we have these questions of looking at life and saying, I can't understand how the director, the producer, and the writer can use this scenario, this scene, filmed in France for a Western, you know, movie on politics in the U.S. I just don't see how it fits. And my role is limited to the one scene in France that they're filming, you know, before they... I don't even know what the whole story is. It just doesn't make sense to me until I see the movie. Then I see, you know, I didn't realize that the last scene was shot at the beginning, not at the end. It wasn't in sequence. It was pieced together. And I didn't know that we had those mountains in the background. Well, we didn't. They were put in, you know, as a part of the film playing and editing. I mean, the point is, it's like a football player. You know, if you're in the line, you see dirt and the jersey of the guy in front of you and his face, which is not helping. And that's about it. That's about what you see. You don't see the play. But somehow it gets done. Yes?
I have a question about prayer. I don't know if that's a rabbit trail.
No, prayer is a great question.
Is prayer like asking the director, the producer, the writer to write something else in? Or is it more teaching yourself that you would play your role well? How does
prayer fit into the decrees and the sovereignty of God? That's one of the five big questions on sovereignty. The answer that is most satisfying to me is that prayer is not just petition, or not even primarily petition. It's communion. Prayer is a way in which my personal relationship with God is cultivated. And He listens to me like I listen to my children. With loving ears, wanting to respect what He hears and to accommodate where my heart is at that time in my growth, and to do that in a way that is going to work for my ultimate good. When my grandson Alex comes to me and asks for something, my response to him is going to be dictated by two forces. One, I want to please him. I want to give him what he wants, unless it's going to be for his lack of development, plus going to hurt him temporarily or long term. Then that takes precedent. So if there's a sense in which I have a dynamic relationship with him. If he doesn't ask, it's not going to come to my attention. But, so his asking does make a difference. But my response to that is conditioned on my knowledge of what's in his best interest. And my response is going to not be unloving because of that. It's going to be ultimately very loving, although he's going to say, but, you know, why do I have to go to bed? Like last night, they were over. We put them to bed at 8:30. They don't want to go to bed. But I recognize your parents want us to put you to bed at that time. It's for your best interest that you basically need a good night's sleep. They don't know that. They feel as though they're being abused by their grandparents. And they're putting them to bed. We don't feel guilty one bit doing that. Although, you know, we basically feel attention. We'd like to basically give them what they want. But we know that's not in their best interest. I mean, God feels the same way. Prayer is real, it's powerful, it makes a difference, but it's overridden by the wisdom, knowledge of God. So that's why our prayers oftentimes aren't answered the way we want them to be. And we feel as though God isn't listening, or He basically doesn't care. But that doesn't satisfy all the scenarios. I've got some scenarios that shoot holes in that, I know. But that covers a lot of what's going on. Yeah.
What about the role of the enemy in all this, as in the case of Job?
Yes. Or in the case of the Satan's role in the case of Jesus' temptation.
Yeah.
Where Jesus has real needs. I mean, he has a mandate from God to control the world. All the kingdoms will be his. He's Lord of all. And Satan says, I'll work with you. I'll give you all of it. All you have to do it is my way. Just cut corners here and there, do it my way, and you'll have it all. And that is, of course, the kind of temptation Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are facing. We'll see next week. You are in a position of power now. You can make a difference for Israel if you just cooperate. All you've got to do is bow down to the image. I mean, it's a technicality, guys. Don't get hung up on this. And you won't lose your power. You won't burn in the fiery furnace. And you're going to be, you'll go along with peer pressure. Everyone's doing it. You can do it too. It's going to be in your best interest. And furthermore, God puts you in this position. He doesn't want you to get out of it. Satan wants you to get out of it. He's trying to get you out of the position. Resist Satan. Power of the image. We face the same thing in terms of a lot of the decisions we make. We think the means and the ends, we confuse the means and the ends. We justify the means with the ends. It's in God's best interest that I keep my job. Therefore, I'm going to keep my mouth shut. Therefore, I'm going to open my mouth. One way or the other. No other comments, questions, or... But this theme will continue. The next chapter is fascinating in terms of how this works out. Yes, Jean?
What would Sproul think of this class?
He would probably say it is the one thing that has not been ordained by God. So I don't think he'd I don't think he would have violent objections. He would just express it very differently. And I think he would have probably some objections. I mean, to people who really are solving the problem of sovereignty by saying God is completely sovereign over every detail and all the rest is mystery, that free will is an illusion, we really aren't free at all, they are going to be, they're going to tend to be gun-shy and on a witch hunt for any mention of freedom because it seems threatening to God. Or responsibility. They would uphold responsibility but not freedom. And they'd say this is threatening to the sovereignty of God. And my argument would be, your God is too small. My God is like LeBron James. He's not afraid of my moves or my shot. Doesn't intimidate him in the least. Matter of fact, I can do anything I want. I'm completely free. It's not going to make a difference. Ultimately, in his purposes.